You may proceed.
May it please the court, David Hopper on behalf of Celia Falco as trustee of the Dimitri Georgiadis Trust. This case involves interpretation, or rather, plain reading of trust language by which the trustee determined, as she was tasked to do under that trust language, that Paul Georgiadis and his brother Basil had violated the terms of the trust by attempting to interfere with the trust administration according to its plain terms. When she made that determination, after investigating the facts and asking for their input, she was sued in the Henrico Circuit Court in a complaint that does not allege that she acted in bad faith. The trust provides that absent dishonesty, fraud, or bad faith, proof of that, that the decision of my trustee shall be final.
So nothing in the complaint implicitly or explicitly alleged that the trustee committed a bad faith decision?
No, sir. And in fact, the way the pleadings make up the case, they allege, and this is on page 3 of the appendix, that the trustee employed an arbitrary and capricious understanding of the meaning and effect of the no contest clause, an understanding contrary to both the grantor's intent as well as the laws and public policy.
So a really, really wrong interpretation of the text, but not a bad faith.
Not a bad faith. And bad faith, by everyone's admission, is a bad act done fraudulently, done dishonestly.
At the demur hearing, did the issue of bad faith come up, and was there any concession made at that point?
That was the subject of the demur, their failure to plead bad faith. They argued they did not have to, and the trial court simply said, well, there's enough in the complaint for me to determine whether they follow the terms of the trust. And that was it. And that's the basis on which the case proceeded. And at trial, there was no evidence introduced of bad faith, and they continued to argue that they did not have to show bad faith.
When did bad faith first come into the case from the trial judge's point of view? Was it after the motion to reconsider?
It would have come into the case at the demur stage.
Well, I mean from the trial judge's point of view.
There was a motion to strike at the end of the case in chief on the basis that they had not proved bad faith, and he summarily denied that. And then we went forward with our evidence. And our evidence was that the trustee had acted in good faith. She consulted with counsel, not only the counsel who drafted the trust, but also independent counsel. She contacted by letter Paul and Basil and asked for their input, told them that she was concerned that this may have been a violation. She was undertaking to investigate it, asked them to provide input, advised them to find their own lawyer.
So you never gave up the objection that it was never pled?
Never. We had to proceed on the case as it went forward. And they didn't argue the case as a bad faith case. Throughout the trial, they kept saying they didn't have to prove it.
Why did the trial judge reach out and grab that issue?
Well, he ruled by letter opinion without addressing the bad faith issue at all. Simply ruled that they had not violated the provision of the issue. We filed a motion to reconsider, pointing out again, that under the terms of the trust, there was required to be proof of bad faith or her decision was final. And summarily, at that hearing, he said that although it was possible that a settlor could grant his trustee this kind of discretion, that the decision that she made was not a correct one, and it was bad faith to say that it was. That was the only statement he ever made about bad faith.
Counsel, let me bring you to that particular part of this case. As you said, the reason that he made the decision that he did, saying there was no bad faith, was because he determined that the actions taken by the beneficiaries did not attack or contest the September trust. And I know you discussed that in your brief. I'm a little concerned about under which assignment of error that might fall. But I would like you to address the issue of why the trial court was wrong in his interpretation that the August trust was not the same trust as the September trust, and that the contest and the letters that were addressed contesting the trust were addressed to the August trust, not to the September trust. Because that, as I understand it, that was the basis of the court's decision that it was bad faith because there was no attack on the September trust.
That was what he stated was the basis of his decision. It was an incorrect decision. In other words, he inferred bad faith from the fact that he found it was an incorrect decision. That is true.
He found it because there was no attack on the September trust, only on the August trust.
And it's addressed in the assignment of error that the trial court erred in finding that their conduct did not violate the terms of the trust.
Which is,
I believe, the third assignment of error.
To interfere with the administration of the trust.
Yes. And what he found was, well, the letter opinion said they did not interfere with the trust agreement. And by that, he meant the trust as amended by the September 21st amendment. He inserted the word agreement in the trust document where it does not appear. Trust says, if you contest or challenge this trust agreement, that's a violation. Or if you attempt to interfere in any way with the administration of this trust, not the trust agreement, but this trust, that's a violation.
But the trial court said on motion for rehearing that when you pointed that out, he said that doesn't change the insertion of that word trust agreement. He interpreted it to be trust in both instances. So he rejected that use of agreement as being a substantive part of his decision.
Well, there is a distinction, Your Honor, and this is the source of the problem. There is only one trust. It was started in 1989, amended and restated in August of 2012, and amended again in September. But it's only one trust. It has a single res. It is a thing apart. And what the interference with the attempted interference with the trust was not simply to do away with the September amendment. The attempted interference was to terminate the trust. If you look at the January 4th letter they sent to the widow threatening her with litigation, their solution and their way for her to avoid litigation was to agree with them to terminate the entire trust and distribute out its assets one-third to each of them in defiance of the dispository plan of the settlement.
Counsel.
No, go ahead.
I'm a little bit more simple-minded than some of my colleagues. I want to step back a second. A no contest clause. I always like the term interorum for these clauses, mostly because it's really impressive when I use Latin, even though I don't know Latin. But it's intended to strike fear. It's intended to be held up as something, just as a talisman, where you say, here is this clause. Don't cross the line that this clause lays out. Do you agree with that generally?
I think that very often they are that, but the cardinal rule of reading anything in a will of trust is that the plain language of the settlor or the testator controls.
I understand that.
And you don't get to the intent if the language is clear.
So your answer implies that it's possible to have a secret interorum clause.
Well, it wouldn't be intended necessarily as interorum if it were secret.
It would be intended as a gotcha?
It would be intended perhaps as
a gotcha.
A canary in a coal mine, a prophylactic effect. If someone is willing to rush through and do one of these bad things, I don't want to deal with it anymore. It should be over. They should be out. And just like the testator could say, anyone who wears a red tie to my funeral is out. Is there any logical reason? Now, you might question whether he was rational in making that provision, but there's no logical reason why he couldn't intend that.
Okay. Now, answer me this. In terms of the actions by the remainder beneficiaries that are alleged to have violated the no contest clause, state, please, one by one, what are the actions that are alleged to have violated the no contest clause that occurred after the remainder beneficiaries learned of the no contest clause?
The basis of the decision was not on anything that happened after they learned it.
Okay. So every action, that is alleged to have violated it occurred before they knew the clause existed.
There were actions afterwards, but they're not the subject of this appeal. For example, they argued against the enforceability in a proceeding. They argued against the enforceability of the trustee's decision being final with knowledge of the knowledge. But
that premature, has not been challenged, and at least in this proceeding,
it's not an issue in this proceeding.
Okay,
it all has to do with coming out of the gate, and the testator, had he wanted to, could have said anyone who does these things with knowledge of this provision is out, and he did not say that.
Okay.
He simply said if you engage in this conduct, you are no longer a beneficiary.
My question's been answered. I appreciate it.
I would like to follow up with a question, I guess, but actually an example or a hypothetical. If the August trust had a no contest clause in it, and then subsequently it was amended in September, removing the no contest clause, and the beneficiaries came in with the same documents challenging the August trust, not the September one, the August trust, would they be prohibited, or what would be your analysis of
that? Well, when you say, and I want to make sure you're using the same terms the same way, when you say challenging the August trust, do you mean doing what they did? In other words,
but identifying it as a challenge to the August trust.
How?
Well, the trust as it existed in August.
Yes.
The trust as it existed in August.
Mm-hmm.
If there was no contest clause in effect at the testator's death, then no, that would not be a problem. But again, you're drawing a distinction between challenging the trust and challenging a particular version of the trust agreement. You can challenge a trust without knowing certainly any of or most of its terms. And I dare say that no party to this could recite all the terms of that trust. It's, you know, a long, complicated document. But if you say, I want, and by the way, there are references to the August trust in the letters that they sent. The trust itself says this trust can be identified by anything that reasonably points out what the name of it is. And the name of it was the Dimitri B. Georgiadis Trust. So the fact that they referred to this trust, everyone knew what they were talking about when they said, we want to terminate this trust and divvy out the assets a third to each.
Well, they didn't know because they didn't know about the fact that the trust now had a no contest and that the trust now had additional residual beneficiaries. They didn't know about that.
No. And again,
so
that goes
they didn't
back
know
to
about that trust.
Well, no, they knew about the trust. They didn't know about that provision in the operative trust documents. And that's the distinction. Because the attempt is directed at interference with the administration of the trust, however it's constituted, versus a contest or challenge to this trust agreement, which might refer only to the September document. If I could, I would like to reserve the last minute or so of my time.
All right.
May it please the Court, John O'Haron on behalf of Paul and Basil Georgiadis, and with me at council table is Mike Matheson. I want to turn directly to this distinction that the trial court upheld and the court's questions refer to, the August versus September. What we are dealing with here is an inter vivos trust, which, as this court held last year in Jimenez, is a legal relationship. It's a legal relationship regarding certain property between the testator, the beneficiaries, and the trustee. This legal relationship began perhaps in 1989 when the decedent here first drafted a trust. The terms of that legal relationship then changed in August when he restated his trust. The terms of that legal relationship then changed again in September. My clients had no knowledge of that change in the terms.
May I ask you this? As you know, there are ALRs, there are digests, there are dozens and dozens of no contest cases throughout American jurisprudence.
Yes.
Could you find a single one that says that the no contest clause is a matter of law, where it's not otherwise written in the clause, is inapplicable to a contester who does not know of the no contest clause?
I'm not aware of a case that says that, Your Honor. I would point out two things. One is that I think it necessarily follows, given the policy purposes for no contest provisions, which is one of the main purposes, which is to reduce litigation, to reduce familial disputes, to reduce those costs associated with that.
Maybe it's also to reduce conflict among your heirs and to eliminate it as much as you can without arguments later as to whether or not people had notice or they knew it was in effect in August or September.
That's true, but the beneficiaries, potential beneficiaries who are potentially violating a no contest clause, the purpose of eliminating disputes cannot possibly be met if those beneficiaries are not aware of the existence of the no contest clause itself. The existence of this prophylactic measure cannot have its intended effect of having the beneficiaries not file an action, not file a contest, unless they know the existence. Excuse me.
Next question is, the clause makes the trustee the arbiter of this decision, and the trial judge appears to have triggered the bad faith exception to that case of forum clause, if you want to call it that. It was never pled. We never argued it. The trial judge looks like it came out as an after-the-fact thing when it was clear to the judge, shoot, the arbitrary and capricious provision was not going to trigger this. It just looks like make weight at the end of the case. Dissuade me of that.
The first point that I would make is we believed, said to the trial court, and continue to believe that we do not have to allege bad faith, regardless of the terms of the trust. As outlined in the mandatory provisions of the Uniform Trust Code, 64.2-703.
Did you ever allege in any pleading bad faith?
No, we did not expressly allege bad faith.
So how is the trial judge's bad faith holding possibly going to survive appeal?
What we did allege in the complaint is that the decision of the trustee was arbitrary and capricious, and we asked the trial court to adjudicate the rights of the beneficiaries because of this no contest provision.
Well, in theory, you could win that if the court were to agree that arbitrary and capricious is the standard for kicking out the trustee's discretion. But I'm asking you very specifically, if hypothetically that weren't the right answer, and you actually had to prove bad faith, the trial judge's holding is based upon the absence of argument of bad faith, the absence of evidence of subject of bad faith, and the absence of pleadings of bad faith. How does that aspect of the case survive our review?
I think because we asked the court to adjudicate the rights of the beneficiaries, to declare whether this no contest provision had been violated, the issue of whether the trustee acted in good faith was necessarily before the trial court because of the mandatory provisions of the Uniform Trust Code. So 64.2-703 requires, regardless of the terms of the trust, that a trustee administer the trust in good faith. Because we asked the trial court to adjudicate their rights to determine whether the trustee had made the correct decision, my first response would be that the trial court was then armed with 64.2-703, so to speak, to determine whether good faith was met.
Did you ever specifically say, I'm asking you to find this trustee exercised bad faith, Your Honor?
No. We told the trial court, we think the facts here are sufficient to find bad faith, but we do not believe that we need to allege or prove bad faith.
And you didn't allege or prove.
Excuse me?
And you did not allege it or assert it.
We did not expressly allege it using those two words, bad faith. The other response that I would have on the question of bad faith is that as we have a disagreement with our opposing counsel as to the standard of review applicable to that decision. So to the extent the court reaches the facts of this case and whether we had to allege bad faith and whether the trial court was correct to find bad faith, that decision is subject to a standard of review for plain error. Bad faith, by definition, and in every context in which this court has addressed it, is a question of dishonest belief or purpose. That's a finding of fact. We outline in our brief, and I would rely on our brief for that portion, but we think the evidence here is sufficient to support, on that standard of review, a finding that this was not plain error. But because the Uniform Trust Code says that a testator cannot draft around the duties of a trustee to administer the trust in good faith, as well as in accordance with the terms and purposes of the trust, as well as in accordance with the interests of the beneficiaries, bad faith is not the sole defining standard. The trustee believes that the parameters of her discretion are only limited by the terms of the trust. That is not the case. The Uniform Trust Code limits both the parameters of her discretion and the authority and power of the courts of the Commonwealth to review her exercise of that discretion. So to the extent that the trustee interprets and applies the no-contest provision violative of the terms of the trust itself, that is contrary to the language of the no-contest provision, and to the extent that the trustee applies and interprets the bad faith clause as removing, this is under subsection B11, 64.2-703, which states that a testator cannot draft around, quote, the power of the court to take such action as may be necessary in the interest of justice.
Well, that means there will always be litigation then. If you're a settlor and you want to set up a trust that eliminates fighting among your heirs and your children and your second wife, there's always going to be litigation because you can't give the trustee the discretion to make the call without a judge exercising essentially de novo review of it later, which means there will be litigation every time.
Well, I don't think the General Assembly intended, and I don't think the language supports a conclusion that that provision is meant to bring every action to court. But what's clear from the Uniform Trust Code under 64.2-703, as well as the multiple cases from this court, I just cite a couple, the Nations Bank case, the Hoffman case, and the Trout case. A trustee, even when armed with the broadest possible discretion, is nevertheless that her decision made, his or her decision made pursuant to that discretion, is nevertheless subject to review by the courts of the Commonwealth for either an arbitrary or capricious exercise of it, for an abuse of discretion, for a failure to use reasonable judgment in accordance in administering the trust. The Nations Bank and Hoffman case, I think, are particularly applicable here. In those two cases, the trustee was vested with the broadest possible discretion to invest assets and to allocate the trust assets for the benefit of the beneficiaries as needed. And those are the types of discretionary language that are frequently found in the cases. But even in those cases where the broadest possible discretion was found, the court made clear that if you abuse that discretion, if you act arbitrarily or capriciously, then your decision can be reviewed and can be overturned by the courts of the Commonwealth.
But in none of those cases did the settlor create in the document itself, the trust document itself, a standard of review.
That's
in other
true.
Words, the trustees in those cases were exercising the discretion given by trust law and in Uniform Trust Act. But here we have a provision that's unique, which says, no, there are three ways this trustee should be reversed by some court: bad faith, dishonesty, or fraud. You didn't allege fraud or dishonesty, and you didn't allege bad faith. You ended up with a bad faith ruling, which is curious to me, but you didn't allege bad faith. So why can't a settlor do that? Why does the law say you can't do that? It's your money, it's your trust, but we're not going to allow you to do that.
64.2-703 says that you can't do that. It says that regardless of the terms of a trust, regardless of a testator's intent and how he drafts it into the trust document, you cannot draft around the duty of good faith. You cannot draft around the duty to administer the trust in accordance with the terms of the trust.
Okay, good faith is the antonym of bad faith. This settlor didn't attempt to do that.
I'm not sure I follow your question, Your Honor.
The settlor here didn't say, even if it's bad faith, doesn't matter, the trustee gets to make the call. There was no effort to get around bad faith.
The trustee, by limiting review of the trustee, the testator, by limiting review of the trustee's decision to either bad faith, dishonesty, or fraud, attempts to eliminate the other duties of a trustee. If a court is unable to review the decision of a trustee that's directly contrary to the terms of the trust, a trustee no longer has the duty to administer a trust in accordance with the terms of the trust. And that's what 64.2-703.
I promise you my last question.
Says.
Isn't that circular? Because the terms of the trust say, and I want my trustee to interpret this other term.
I don't believe it's circular. I think if a testator is trying to set up a trust where the only way for a decision applying and interpreting the terms of a trust, the only way for that to be reviewable is by proof of bad faith, that is directly contrary to 64.2-703. Regarding...
Well, can I ask you a question,
yes,
now, sir? If we don't agree with the trial court with regard to which trust, if there was more than one, was attacked by these letters, was applicable to these letters, The trial court was pretty clear that he found, it seems in his letter, saying that the letters that were sent were in fact challenges to the trust, contested the trust. Aren't we then stuck with a factual finding that says the trust, that this was a contest, and therefore forget about the fact that we don't have to get into the bad faith because the trial court found that they violated the no contest clause?
Two responses, Your Honor. The first is that as we assign in our cross, we assign cross error because of that language in the trial court's opinion, that these letters were as enumerated in the no contest clause. To the extent that means that these letters could attempt to interfere with the administration of the trust, we argue on cross error that that should not be the case in Virginia, that for public policy reasons, a no contest clause should be limited to legal conduct, not non-legal conduct as innocuous as writing letters or conversations or text messages. The other argument, Your Honor, is that not only is there the August versus September distinction, and we believe the trial court was correct in that regard. Our other argument is that these letters, even if non-legal conduct could fit in Virginia, that these letters simply were not attempts to interfere with the administration of this trust, that they do not rise to the level of an attempt. These were two letters sent, one to the decedent's former counsel, a litigation hold letter. This may be the subject of a contest. That's all it said. The other letter was to their stepmother, and this is the letter that the trustee relies on largely, that said, explore the possibility. And the letter itself states several times, uses the several times the word propose. My client proposed to his stepmother a non-judicial settlement pursuant to 64.2-709. This is not a case where this was prior to him being aware of the no contest clause. Once they found out the existence of the no contest clause, there was no more pursuit of a non-judicial settlement agreement pursuant to that statute. If they had filed a petition in circuit court, perhaps then this should be an attempt to interfere. But these provisions must be construed narrowly. They have to be construed against forfeiture in favor of beneficiaries. These are conditions subsequent which are forfeiting vested interests in estates. And so for that reason, the words attempt to interfere should not be construed as broadly as the trustee has argued here. They should be construed more narrowly so that they do not cover. If instead of my client sending a letter to their stepmother, if they had talked between the two of them, two brothers, hey, should we pursue a non-judicial settlement agreement? Is that an attempt to interfere with the administration of the trust? If they had seen their stepmother in the grocery store, would that be an attempt to interfere? We think the conduct by which someone forfeits vested interests needs to be more formal, needs to be more significant. If my clients had filed a petition pursuant to 64.2-709, that would be a different story.
Okay, counsel, part of that letter says, Basil and I propose that the trust be set aside and dissolved, and you're saying that language is not an attempt to interfere with the administration of the trust.
Yes, I believe that this letter by itself is not. If my clients had filed a petition saying, court, we want you to set aside and dissolve this trust, that is an attempt to interfere. I think because
okay,
of
so
what
you
we're...
Okay, so you say this language would be an attempt to interfere. It's just that a letter is not sufficient. It has to be illegal.
I think it would be a different case if our clients had asked the circuit court using that exact language, dissolve this trust. But I think the question is what act is legally significant, is formal enough to be legally significant.
If would you my draw the line at filing a lawsuit then?
I think that line makes sense, and that's why across the country, narrowly and strictly construing these provisions, you have the distinction between legal conduct versus non-legal conduct. That's why we assign cross error and lay out that authority from other jurisdictions. But the formal act necessary to trigger a forfeiture, we think, should be something more significant and more formal than simply a letter or a conversation. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. A minute and 9 seconds, rebuttal.
To Your Honor's point, it was not just a letter proposing a settlement or proposing resolution. It said, and if you don't agree to this, we will sue you for undue influence and incompetence of the settlor, and you better tell us real quick if you want to avoid all these legal expenses. It wasn't just a proposal.
Does it make any difference, though, that that letter was to the stepmother, not to the trustee?
It does not, because it is, they admit that the purpose of it was to get her to agree with them to terminate the trust. They Basil even characterized it as an attempt to get her to go along and terminate the trust. So the fact that it was directed at her doesn't really change the analysis, because their goal was terminating the trust. And it is only one trust. It is the trust. In terms of limiting what a testator can do to only barring conduct that, in which that they file suit, number one, Virginia respects above all else the ability of a testator or a settlor to direct his assets and his estate as he wishes. And we've cited two cases in our brief in which that was not the case. And I see I'm out of time.
Does he answer your question? All right, thank you very much. Call the next.